I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Guns in schools. Now there's talk about deputizing teachers after December's shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut. Others say teachers are already busy enough educating children without guarding them against armed intruders. I'll talk with Orlando Sentinel columnist Beth Kassib about how this debate is playing out in Central Florida. Plus, 90.7's Amy Green talks about why environmentalists say Everglades restoration is the best way to brace for climate change. That's ahead on Intersection. Schools are back in session after the winter holidays, and in the wake of December's mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut, everybody is talking about school safety. Beth Kassib has been writing about this issue as an Orlando Sentinel columnist. Beth, good to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me.
So you published a column recently. It was actually a quiz for readers on where they stand on guns, and you put out questions like, will restricting magazine capacity, the number of bullets that a gun can take to keep firing without reloading, will that keep us safer? And other questions like, should school teachers be armed and trained to take down assailants? And this is something that's very much out in the public sphere right now, an issue that's being talked about. But the idea of the quiz was to find out where people stand and to get feedback from readers. So what did you hear back?
Yeah, you know, the quiz was designed for really two reasons. I had kind of two purposes for the quiz. One was to crystallize people's viewpoints on these issues. The quiz was multiple choice, so I guess you could have Christmas treated it if you wanted to, but it wouldn't have done you very good. The idea was to present a kind of a viewpoint of both extremes on the gun debate, which we know are represented so loudly, and then to also represent kind of a middle ground. And then the other point of the quiz, too, was to hopefully get people to see that there is a middle ground and that you don't have to belong to one extreme or the other. And in fact, I think most of us do not. I think most people fall somewhere in the middle. So the reaction to the quiz was really interesting. I had readers writing in, telling me how they scored, where they fell on the spectrum. I had people who said my liberal bias was showing through, and I had people who said my conservative bias was showing through. So I guess it was all kind of in how they read the quiz. But it was very interesting, and I think it provoked people to think about the issue a little bit.
What surprised you about it?
About the reaction? You know, some people, I think, were surprised by their answer and how they scored. You know, I had one guy who wrote to me who said he was an Army veteran, he was a gun owner, that he certainly believed in gun rights, but he actually scored a little bit higher up toward what I guess most people would consider the anti-gun viewpoint, although I don't really think there is a solid anti-gun viewpoint out there. But I think some people were surprised by their own responses, and I liked that.
And take us through. So after you finished taking the quiz, you were one of three outcomes?
That's right. You were one of three outcomes, and you either scored on a number that set you toward, lifetime NRA member, fan of Charlton Heston, but not for his acting. The other extreme being you'd rather live in a world where only soldiers and cops have guns. And then the middle being you're in the middle and you're wishing kind of both of those sides would listen more.
Interesting. You had a number of responses from readers. One, Carol from Winter Haven, wrote in and said, quote, "We already ask more of teachers than we ask of any other human in the working world. Thinking back to my own teachers, I would be terrified if one of those sweet ladies were packing heat. Would the teachers have police training on top of their master's degrees and specialist certificates?" You actually shadowed a teacher for a day last year and wrote about it. Having that experience, what do you think about this discussion in terms of arming teachers?
You know, that reader points out a really important point, and that is the practical side of implementing a plan like that. I did shadow a teacher last month. I spent the entire day with her. We met before dawn at 5:30 in the morning. I went home with her after school. We spent hours together after school. And, you know, there isn't a lot of extra time in her day for firearms training. And I certainly wouldn't expect that we would arm teachers or administrators in our schools without giving them training. So, you know, the practical point of view there is a good one. And I think, you know, you can't dismiss that. How would you actually fit that in to a teacher's day? They're already going to a number of training workshops every quarter, every 9 weeks, just for things they have to do in the classroom. Adding security on top of their job, I think, would be quite a bit to ask.
You know, the Sentinel did ask readers, would armed teachers improve school safety? And the results from that Sentinel poll, 62% saying yes, 38% saying no. Any surprises there in the feedback that you've gotten?
I think a lot of people saw what happened in Connecticut and want to come up with anything that they think could possibly prevent something like that from happening in the future. But there is another point to consider, and that is, you know, as parents, you know, I think the wheels in our head are constantly cranking and thinking about how to mitigate risk for our child, how to, I think most moms and dads, they walk into a room and they can quickly scan the room for sharp objects and other dangers. And that's why we do things like we put fences around our pools and we put childproof locks on our cabinet doors and our kitchens and our bathrooms. So I think, you know, putting more guns in schools, I don't think if people really think about that, that they would see that as a way to mitigate risk.
You know, you're, of course, the mother of two young children. Are you able to separate, I guess, your professional viewpoint on what impact that might have versus your own personal view? Or do you think it's tough to separate that?
Sure, it is tough to separate that. I mean, on an issue like this, I think my personal viewpoint actually makes a lot of sense to include in the column. And so I try to do that because I think if you approach things as a parent, you think about things maybe a little bit differently than you otherwise would. And I think that's a really important thing to do, especially when you're talking about something like guns in elementary schools. You know, we had a story in the newspaper recently about a company that is selling bulletproof backpacks and other, you know, bulletproof gear that, you know, you might be able to buy for your child in hopes of protecting your child. And that story struck me as a parent, you know, at because, again, you know, you're kind of pulled in both directions. On one hand, you think, well, gosh, if there's anything I could do that would help my child in this situation, maybe I would do it. But then on the other side, you think, you know, how sad it is that these are the sorts of things that we're contemplating.
Certainly a personal issue and a lot of important issues raised by it. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 WMFE-FM. I'm Mark Simpson talking with Orlando Sentinel columnist Beth Kassab about guns and school safety. Where do you stand on this issue? Let us know on Facebook or Twitter. You can send an email to intersection@WMFE.org. You know, talking about safety in schools, Beth, just recently Orange County Mayor Teresa Jacobs proposed and was able to get approved money to put sheriff's deputies in elementary schools for the rest of the school year. They were already being stationed as resource officers at middle and high schools before the shooting at Sandy Hook. Do you think, is this necessary, overreaction, or appropriate given the climate of dialogue about guns and safety in schools right now in the country?
I think it was a very appropriate reaction. I think the magnitude of what happened at Sandy Hook was so great that there was an enormous demand to do something. And I think, you know, Teresa Jacobs should be commended for moving so quickly on it. school resource officers in our schools are nothing drastic, nothing new. Like you said, they are in most middle schools and high schools. I think having them at the elementary schools can be an asset for a lot of reasons. Certainly, there's some security there. But also, I think for elementary school kids, police officers are great role models. So I think the benefits there are great. But when you look at what we're really getting for that, you got to keep in mind that, for one thing, very expensive. The sheriff's department didn't already have money allocated for that.
Right now it's being paid for by overtime. And it's not clear, the mayor said, how far along that will go, if it will even continue in the next academic year.
Right. So they're going to have to evaluate the benefits and whether it's worth spending the money to do that again next school year. Right now, I think what they've committed to is through the end of this school year. And so there are certainly some benefits there. And I think it was great that they reacted. School resource officers are not a foolproof measure in schools against school shootings. I think a lot of people probably forget that there was a school resource officer on the campus in Littleton, Colorado during the Columbine shooting. Unfortunately, that officer, he did take a couple shots at the shooters in that case. He missed. There was chaos. There were all kinds of issues at play. So it's not necessarily going to prevent a tragedy. And it'll be interesting to see how they evaluate that, whether they decide the benefits are worth the expense.
Talk to me about what you think, even for maybe even your own children, seeing police officers in schools, if that's an unusual circumstance. Do you think it puts children on edge?
I think having a school resource officer in the school doesn't put children on edge. I think, like I said before, I think police officers can be great role models for kids, especially young kids. Now, if you're talking about every teacher being armed, if you're talking about so many officers in a school that it's a really highly visible situation, then yeah, maybe the kids do start to feel that there's a security issue there.
And that's been talked about in Lake County by school board member Bill Mathias, suggested arming teachers with guns, deputizing them through rigorous police training. Do you think, given the climate in Florida politically, you could see movement on a training suggestion like that?
You know, I think it's going to be discussed. I think there's no doubt about that. I'm sure we'll hear talk of that during the legislative session this year because of what's happened and because people are voicing these issues at the local county level. Will they get much traction? Personally, I don't think so. I think you're dealing with, again, the expense of doing all of that, the practicality, the fact that school budgets have been cut in recent years. School teachers have been, asked to do even more with less. So I can't see that idea getting a lot of traction, nor do I think it would be the answer to combating violence in schools.
What do you see, if any, connection to this debate that's going on right now about safety in schools, gun laws, and the Stand Your Ground law in Florida, which has been so controversial over the past year, given the Trayvon Martin case up in Sanford?
There's not really a connection between Stand Your Ground and what happens in schools. I mean, those are two very separate things. I do think we're going to see a debate on Stand Your Ground this session. I don't know how far that will go. I think what ties those two together is the idea of gun rights in general. And I think that, for better or for worse, this idea that arming teachers represents, better gun rights. And I think that for some people, Stand Your Ground represents better gun rights. So I guess people might draw a correlation there. But I don't know that those things are necessarily true. And I do think that a lot of that discussion does take place, again, on the extreme ends of the debate. And I think most of us fall much closer to the middle. And I really, would love to see some lawmakers and other people in the community who represent that middle ground speak louder about it and try to rein in kind of those extreme points of view.
Who do you think has the option for more influence in this dialogue? lawmakers in Tallahassee or folks at the local level dealing with those individual schools and much closer to the children in those local communities?
You know, I think it's going to be both. And I think it, again, is going to go back to funding. You know, there was a debate just within Orange County between the mayor of the county and the mayors of some of the local jurisdictions like Windermere, like Winter Garden, who were saying, hey, you know, we want officers in our schools, too. And the county said, well, listen, you know, you have your own police departments. We don't have jurisdiction over your schools. So, you know, those issues kind of when you start getting to that level, you know, are going to go back to funding. And then that, again, can easily get traced back to Tallahassee. So the conversation is going to come from both directions there. But I think it is great when the local officials respond and do something and frankly, get loud about it because they are the ones who are closest to the people who they're representing and especially to the schools.
Orlando Sentinel columnist Beth Kassab will check back in with you. I know this issue's not going away.
All right. I'd be glad to do it.
Coming up next, a new environmental strategy in Everglades restoration. Everglades restoration is moving as slowly as the waters that fill the famed River of Grass as it runs through South Florida. But reporter Amy Green says at this past weekend's Everglades Coalition Conference in Coral Gables, there's a new emphasis on climate change and continued focus on restoring the famed ecosystem that's exciting environmental advocates. The conference attracted big political names like Interior Secretary Ken Salazar, Governor Rick Scott, and Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who chairs the Democratic National Convention. Here to fill in details is Amy Green. Great to speak with you, Amy.
Hi, Mark. Nice to see you.
So the Everglades, of course, starts up north near Orlando with the Kissimmee River, and it flows all the way down through South Florida, all the way out into the Atlantic Ocean. Where does this long-term effort to try to restore the Everglades stand now?
Well, the centerpiece is the Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, or CERP. And this is the largest environmental restoration project ever in the history of the planet. Its cost, since it was implemented in 2000, nearly has doubled to $13.5 billion, with a B. CERP projects already are underway, but many are still in the works, and they are on hold until they can get a water bill. That stands for Water Resources Development Act. There hasn't been a new water bill in Congress since 2007, and so a lot of these projects are on hold. That's the primary thing that environmentalists now are working on.
So we know this has been going on for a long, long time, but what's new?
Well, I think one of the primary things that has slowed it down in recent years has been this recession that we all have been going through. Like I said, that water bill has been on hold since 2007. The atmosphere, the political atmosphere, the economic atmosphere in Congress is really not into implementing big government spending programs, really not into earmarks. And so environmentalists and environmental advocates have to really work with that kind of atmosphere. It's been a challenge for them.
But Amy Green, how does this correlate then in this no earmark environment with people who say Everglades restoration is really a big jobs creator?
That's right. That's the other strategy, or that's the other message of environmentalists. A few years ago, the Everglades Foundation commissioned an economic impact study on the Everglades, and this study found that Everglades restoration over the course of 50 years could create as many as nearly a half million jobs and $46 billion in benefits for South Florida. The study cited water supply protection, enhanced real estate values, better tourism and recreation. That again, is the message that environmentalists are pushing, that Everglades restoration is a job creator in this economic recession.
What kind of jobs are they?
Construction jobs, science jobs, environmentalist jobs, but primarily construction jobs.
How much are local municipalities depending on increased property values in terms of revenue creation when you talk about something like the Everglades restoration?
I think they would tell you that Everglades restoration is important in that regard because the environment is the reason people want to come to Florida. They want to enjoy the sunshine and the waves and the outdoor. They want to come here and enjoy the outdoors, and the Everglades is part of that. If that region were allowed to deteriorate environmentally, Of course, that would affect property values. Of course, that would cause people not to want to live in a place that's not very nice and not very beautiful and not very attractive. And so I think that is the argument you would hear in that regard, that Everglades restoration improves property values because it makes Florida a better place to live and it makes Florida a place where people want to come and enjoy outdoor recreational activities.
Do you get a sense that right now, though, there's a fine balance that's been struck between preserving a sensitive environment like the Everglades and allowing people access into the ecosystem to want to experience it in the way that you just described? People come to Florida for the environment. So are you damaging the thing that you're trying to protect by promoting it as a tourism attraction?
That's a great question, Mark. And you do see that debate taking place. You've seen litigation in recent months between environmentalists and hunters, for example, who want to go into the Everglades or into Big Cypress Preserve in ATVs. And environmentalists feel like those vehicles damage the landscape. And so there was some dispute and some litigation between those two groups on that point. And you're right, Mark, the fundamental issue was preservation versus recreational use. Both groups share the same goal, which is to keep the Everglades, keep Big Cypress, keep that South Florida region a place that is a place where people can go and enjoy the outdoors and not damage it, but to enjoy that place in two different ways.
Do you feel like there's a different perception of the importance of achieving Everglades restoration at the national level in Congress, places like the Department of the Interior, compared to how state lawmakers and Floridians, members of Congress from the state, perceive the issue?
I think that there is a lot of trepidation in Congress for anything that even resembles an earmark. And I think for a lot of congressional members, the Everglades kind of falls into that category because it is a localized project. And so Everglades advocates really are working hard to get the message out that the Everglades, they're trying to portray it as a national treasure, as something that creates jobs across a large region and statewide, and also is important as we go into climate change and rising sea levels. That was another topic that came up at the conference this past weekend.
Yeah, you mentioned that the messaging is changing on areas of climate change and sea level rising. How does that impact the Everglades?
Environmentalists their new message is tying Everglades restoration to climate change. They say Everglades restoration is a good way. In fact, they say it's one of the most important ways to prepare the South Florida region for climate change and rising sea levels. There are projections that sea levels could rise in South Florida by a few feet in the coming decades. And of course, that would be a big problem in South Florida because of the low elevation there. And so environmentalists and Everglades advocates say Everglades restoration is important to prepare for climate change. They call it fighting water with water. They say that restoring freshwater flows through Central Florida and through South Florida. Remember, the Everglades begins near Orlando with the Kissimmee River. They say restoring that natural flow of fresh water through the state pushes back saltwater, pushes back saltwater intrusion in drinking water, and also pushes back saltwater in the groundwater supply. And as that groundwater, as that water table rises up, there's a danger there that water will come up through our porous limestone and flood even the interior parts of the state. At one of the panels that I attended on this subject, Broward County Mayor Kristen Jacobs spoke to that.
You have to fight water with water, and that's what the Everglades represents to us. When we talk about trying to push back against the ocean, the headwaters, the freshwaters of the Everglades that floods into the urban areas, it is absolutely important that we stay engaged and stop the idea that these are sea level issues. They are not Everglades issues, because, in fact, it's all tied to the Everglades.
That was Broward County Mayor Kristen Jacobs. She is among stakeholders in seven counties stretching from Monroe County in the Florida Keys up to Indian River County who have joined in a region-wide organization to prepare for climate change. This organization is called 750, and they say it's the only organization of its kind in the nation.
So talk to me, how does that fighting water with water How do the environmental leaders that want to restore the Everglades propose to make that happen?
Well, that fresh water pushes back against rising salt water. And so it pushes back against salt water as it encroaches into the water table. It pushes salt water back as it encroaches into land areas. And also, flowing fresh water, it actually creates land mass as sediments flow through the fresh water and decaying sediments flow through the fresh water that actually creates land mass that, again, serves as a buffer against rising salt water.
But is there something new and different in the Everglades Restoration long-term plan to use this fighting water with water technique?
Well, one provision of SERP, that Comprehensive Everglades Restoration Plan, that $13.5 billion plan, it does make room for changes in science and in research and new discovery in Everglades restoration. And so there will be room in that massive plan to alter restoration techniques, alter restoration as climate change becomes a reality and as our understanding of the science progresses.
Do you think that the Florida congressional delegation has enough clout to continue to see this long-term project through in this anti-earmark environment?
It is a big, big challenge for sure. The Florida delegation has Senator Bill Nelson, who is a strong friend of the Everglades. Debbie Wasserman Schultz is chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee. But again, it is a big, big problem. Certainly at the conference, the nation's fiscal problems came up. We heard from Republican Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart, who recently established an Everglades caucus in Congress, another friend of the Everglades, but he actually tied the Everglades to the country's debt in this way.
In just, I think it's 32 years, if we continue to go where we're going, it will consume 100% of the federal budget. So what does that mean? Zero money for anything that we care about.
That was Republican Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart. And there he's making the point that at the rate we're going, the country in just a few decades will be paying so much on its debt that no discretionary spending will be left for anything, including Everglades restoration.
Now, of course, there's the water to deal with in the Everglades itself, but there's also a host of invasive species. We've heard about these Burmese pythons, which down in South Florida for a number of years have been a problem. And recently there was a program initiated just this past weekend to try to get people out there hunting these pythons. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, coincidentally, this Everglades conference coincided with the start of a python hunt in the Everglades. This is a state sanctioned hunt. Nearly 800 people signed up for this month-long python challenge. The goal of this thing is to control the population of this invasive species in the Everglades. The state is offering cash prizes to whoever bags the biggest python and the most pythons. That was an activity that I did not participate in over the weekend.
You're not going to get those boots any other way, I don't think.
Nope, doesn't look like it.
We've been speaking with 90.7's Amy Green about Everglades restoration. Amy, thanks for your reporting.
Anytime.
The conversation about what's happening in Florida continues online at WMFE.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.